Does it work? Okay. Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to come here to this wonderful place. Let me say that this work I will talk about, reconstruction of conductivities in the plane, is joined with Jennifer Mueller and Samuel Siltanen on the numerical parts, and with Alex Tamasan on the theoretical parts. Okay. So we already heard some talks about this inverse conductivity problem and electrical impedance tomography. Let me just briefly review the setting here. So the conductivity equation. So I assume we have a smooth domain which is in two dimensions. We have a conductivity in this domain called a gamma, which is bounded from below and bounded from above. So this is our domain here, and the conductivity lives as a function in that domain. So the idea is that if we put an electric potential or a current on the boundary, then it will rise to an electric potential in the domain by Maxwell's equation, as David derived for us this morning. And we end up with this conductivity equation here, where this function is this gamma is the function we're looking for. Okay. And the kind of measurements we're taking is we put a voltage, if, and we can either put a voltage and measure the current flux through the boundary, or we can do the opposite. But anyway, we have pairs of functions, f and g, on the boundary, pairs of Cauchy data for that partial differential equation, if you like. Okay. So what we measure here for the inverse problem is the Dirichlet Neumann map. This map that takes the function f to the function g, and as we already heard, this map is invertible, and we could as well have, for the inverse problem, the Riemann-Dirichlet map. That doesn't really play a role in mathematics. Okay. Okay. So the inverse problem concerns the inversion of this map lambda that takes a conductivity to this Dirichlet-Neumann map. And in my opinion, there are three main questions for this setting here. So the first is the uniqueness question. So we ask if two different conductivity distributions, could they give rise to exactly the same boundary measurements? That is, that we have two different conductivities, but all boundary measurements are the same. That would be kind of bad for this technology. If we had something like that. So, of course, we like that if the boundary measurements agree, then we could say something about that the functions, they should also agree. Okay. The second question concerns the reconstruction. So, for the cases where we have uniqueness, how should we actually compute this conductivity from the boundary data? And third question concerns stability. How do small changes in the measurements affect the solution to the problem? So of course we always measure on the boundary, all measurements are affected with noise, and we like that noise to, even if we have noise, we like to get some good pictures out of the end of the day. Okay, so that was the inverse problem. And of course you can say we'd already heard a great deal about this inverse problem, and is there more to say about it? That's hopefully there is. Okay, let's see. Let me just give you a brief survey of what kind of results are available in the literature. This is kind of technical, but maybe I should move this one here. So as we heard from Jennifer, one of the great breakthroughs in 2D was the paper by Adrian Lachman in Annals in 96, where he showed the uniqueness and reconstruction for this inverse problem. But as you may recall from Jennifer's talk, you needed some kind of transformation of the original equation to some other equation. And to do that transformation, you need essentially two derivatives of the conductivity. And if you're not familiar with these subtle spaces, then just think of these as spaces where you have two derivatives on the conductivity. So there was a uniqueness and a reconstruction algorithm, and that was implemented by Jennifer and Samuel and David. And the we just saw some good results. Later, one of Adrian's students showed stability following the same kind of arguments as was in Adrian's paper. But of course, when we posed the problem, it was clear that this problem could be studied for any kind of conductivities, even if you have jumps. That was also what Nudi was studying here. So if we have jumps in the conductivity, then we can consider this problem. So we'd like to kind of remove these smoothness conditions. And so that was one of the motivations for this paper by Brown and Ullmann, where they showed that if gamma has essentially one derivative, then you still have uniqueness. Later, these three guys, Spanish people, Barcelo and Ruiz, they showed that following the same kind of arguments, that there is also kind of stability, logarithmic stability, for conductivities having one derivative. And more recently, together with Alex, we were able to make a reconstruction algorithm out of this procedure up here. And that's what I'll talk about, and then I'll show you some pictures at the end of the day. And a little technicality here, that this procedure I'll show to you actually holds for this conductivities having one weak derivative. So you don't have to assume that it has really a derivative. What I should say also is that all of these results here, all conductivities, they are continuous functions. So for instance, conductivities having jumps, we cannot treat by these kind of methods yet. But of course, we still hope for progress also in that direction. Okay. So as in Jennifer's talk, the main point is to make a reduction of the conductivity equation to some other kind of equation. So let's take a solution, u, to the conductivity equation, and let's make this vector here. You take the d of u and the d bar of u, and as in Jennifer's talk, the d is this first order derivative, and the d bar is this other one here. So we get a vector v and w, and it turns out that this vector satisfies a system of equations. D bar v is equal to qw, and dw is equal to q bar v, where this q is some potential coming from the conductivity, essentially by taking one derivative here. So that's where we need the one derivative, because we like this q to be in a nice space. Okay. And the point is then that we started this system instead of the original equation, develop a scattering theory for that system, and it turns out to be helpful for the inverse conductivity problem. And the study of this scattering theory goes back to Beals and Kaufmann, who for other reasons studied this system of equations. Okay. And just like in Jennifer's talk, for this system, we like to see that there are special solutions, psi, which is a vector psi 1 and psi 2, to the system, that has a special asymptotic. And in this case, the asymptotic is given by this, we have this m function and an exponential e to the ick, where this m function has the asymptotic, it goes to 1, comma 0, when c goes to infinity. Okay. And maybe I should mention that this here, e to the ick, is not, it doesn't have a modulus 1. So c is a complex number, and k is a complex number. So this e to the ick is growing exponentially in some directions, and is decaying exponentially in other directions. Okay. So, in relation to this, to the potential q, we can then define this scattering transform, the non-physical scattering transform, by this integral here. So we have this unique solution up here, and you can take this integral, and in this integral we have this e of ck, which is an exponential function. We have the potential q on q bar, and we have this m1 here. And let me just mention briefly that in case m1 was exactly equal to its asymptotic value, exactly equal to 1, then this here would just be the Fourier transform of q, or the Fourier transform of q bar, evaluated at a certain point. So this scattering transform is not too far from the Fourier transform. That's one of the thing about it. But it turns out that this is the key intermediate object in the reconstruction procedure. Okay. Maybe I should say that the map from Q, from potentials to this scattering transforms, one can also show a kind of Parseval identity for that, which means that the L2 norm of Q is equal to the L2 norm of this one here for certain classes of potentials. So it has kind of many relations to the Fourier transform, this transform. Okay, and let me just briefly mention a few others here. That if we have the smoothness in Q, that gives a certain decay in this S, and that's kind of important for studying the inverse problem, that this S, when Q has this kind of smoothness, then the S is in LR for R less than 2 and greater than 2. That's will be important in a second. And also, as I will mention here, as you recall from Jennifer's talk, there was this scattering transform, the T, and for sufficiently regular potentials, it turns out that this SQ is actually equal to essentially T of K divided by K. And that may play a role a little later also. So this is not too far from what you've heard already, so I hope you recognize some. Okay. And as I told you, this reconstruction is based on this decomposition. From the boundary data, we first compute the scattering transform, and then from the scattering transform, we compute the conductivity. Okay. And let's see how we can do that. So I'm doing. Okay. So again, the point here is in this first formula that if we do the integration by part in the definition of this SQ, we can get a boundary integral instead, where we have to integrate this function psi 2. We need the boundary values of this exponentially growing solution. So if we can get these boundary values of the solution, we can compute the S of Q. So we need to find a way to compute this boundary value. And there is a theorem here saying that the boundary values of this vector solution psi is given as the unique solution to this system here. And let me just make a little drawing here. So we have three equations. There's one equation here, one equation here, and one here for psi 1 and psi 2, for determining psi 1 and psi 2. And where do these equations come from? Let me just draw something here. So we have here, this is the support of Q. And what do we have? We know that d bar of psi 1 is equal to Q of psi 2. And we know that d of psi 2 is equal to Q bar of psi 1. And then we know that if we go far away from the support here, then psi 1 and psi 2, it grows like e to the I c k times 1 comma 0, like this. This is what we know. Okay. And let me say that the first two equations, they come by considering what's happening outside the domain of interest here. So outside here, the Q is 0. And this means that psi 1 is analytic. This is that d bar psi 1 is equal to 0, means it's analytic. And psi 2 is anti-analytic. And we have this exponential behavior. So writing down by using potential theory, one can get these two equations here, where this SK is kind of a singular potential on the boundary of the object. Okay. The third equation comes by considering what's happening inside our object here. So these psi 1 and psi 2, they came, as you recall, from solving the conductivity equation with certain boundary values. So by looking at what's happening there, we get these kind of equations where this H gamma here is this kind of operator here, lambda gamma d bar d tau to the minus first. This d tau here is the derivative tangential to our boundary here. So we have a derivative along that, or antiderivative along that boundary. Okay. So we have a kind of an explicit representation of the characterization of the boundary values of these exponentially growing solutions. Okay. Let me jump to the next. So how to use this in practice to really compute these values. And then one problem is that if we just try to use all the information that's in here, down here, what we know from up here is that we need the boundary values of psi 2. But the problem is that in this formula here, psi 1 is the part that's exponentially growing. So that's going to be big. This one is going to be small in some sense. So it may be kind of hard to extract information about the small part by solving an equation like this. So let's try to do something a little bit different. So also, as I learned from the work of Jennifer and her collaborators, one could try to use the asymptotic behavior of the functions instead. So one could try to plug in the psi 1, the asymptotic value, in this third equation, which I've written here. And then one can show that, so we plug in the psi 1 here, this e to the ick, and then one can show that this operator here is invertible, has this inverse here, and then we get an approximation for the psi 2. So is this good or not? Let's see in a second. And let me just note one thing here, that when gamma is radial, I'll show an example in a second where I've chosen a radial conductivity, and one reason for doing that is because when gamma is radial, then this H gamma is easily implemented in a Fourier basis. As we heard from David's talk this morning, we know that lambda gamma applied to the En. So when gamma is radial, lambda gamma applied to E to the In theta, these functions are eigenfunctions. So we get lambda n, some eigenvalues, and E to the In theta. And the same happens for this E tor to the minus first, applied to the En, In theta, is essentially 1 over In, E to the In theta. So for this combined operator, we have some very nice eigenfunctions. So that's kind of what makes this easy. Okay, and then we just plug this approximation here into the definition of the scattering transform and end up with this approximation. Okay. So assume we have now the scattering transform. We'd like to consider this second step in the reconstruction method. And it turns out that if we take a suitable linear combination of this M1 and M2, this function satisfies a D-bar equation like this. So D with respect to the second variable, just like in Jennifer's talk. So if we take the derivative with respect to the K-bar, we get back the M plus function and some potential. Now this is the scattering transform that pops up here. So it satisfies this differential equation where this here is known. And it turns out also that when k goes to infinity, then this m plus tends to 1, has this asymptotic also. Okay. And the point of this equation is that we can solve this equation uniquely and use the for we can compute this m plus c and k, and from this m plus we can get the conductivity by evaluating at 0, just as in Jennifer's talk. Maybe I should mention here that this we need to do something slightly different than just considering this. We need to plug in this s instead of this s up here, and use the M tilde to get out of that. But that's just a little technical detail. Okay, so what we do for this step, we have the scattering transform, we plug this one in, we solve the relevant D-bar equation, and we then evaluate at zero, then we get the connectivity. Okay. And how to do this numerically? So if we convolve with this Green's function for the D-bar operator, we get the integral equation, this integral equation, which is equivalent to the other D-bar equation on the previous slide. This is a weakly singular Fredholm equation of the second kind in any LP space LR in the plane. One problem is that this is not really a linear operator. This is a conjugate linear operator, this operator here. But anyway, we can deal with that. In practice, in theory, this scattering transform is not compactly supported. So we need to consider this in the entire plane. But in practice, of course, we have to truncate the scattering transform. So this turns out to, this, at the end of the day, this becomes an equation on a bounded domain. Okay, and let me just introduce this short notation here. We have I plus some operator, this convolution operator, and we have a multiplication inside here, and this D bar there, the conjugate there. Okay. I'm running out of time soon. Okay. So what we'd like to do is to solve this equation here, or this equation here. And to do that, we adapt a method developed by Winiko. And let me just briefly mention how this goes. So we introduce an integer grid in the plane and define discrete approximations of functions by this expression here. And what we do with this convolution operator is we discretize this in the following way here. This is kind of standard way of doing it. But the point here in this discretization is that we still have the convolution structure for the discrete problem. That's going to be important. And then the approximate the discrete equation is this one, get I minus some of these operators. Applied to some function is equal to 1. And the point is that this equation can easily be solved by using some iterative solver as soon as this operator here is implemented. And the reason why it's kind of straightforward to use an iterative solver is because the implementation of this convolution operator can be done very fast by using a fast Fourier transform. And this implementation here, one can show that this is has accuracy O of H, and this is also fast. It's n squared log n because of the Fourier transform. And one can even do better if we introduce a two-grid scheme, and I'll not go into that at all. But we can do things even faster than this. Okay, and let me just here last show you just a toy example with the radial conductivity. So if we take this as our test conductivity, here's the profile plot. It has certain singularities, at least in the derivatives. So this is the test conductivity we'd like to see. Then we can compute the scattering transform by solving the forward problem, and we get something like this, which may not really not be so interesting to look at. But just one thing is that the scattering transform has certain symmetries also. It's not really symmetric, but it has certain symmetries. Okay. Then we could compute the eigenvalues of the Dirichlet-Neumann map for that particular example, then get that H gamma operator by using these two definitions. And from that h gamma, we could then solve this boundary integral, this boundary equation I was mentioning. And what we end up with is this scattering transform like this, which has some of the same. Let me just, maybe I should put this on again. Has some of the same features, but when we approach something like 15 or whatever, this one starts to behave in an interesting way, one could say. Then it starts to become inaccurate. So at some point, this one has to be truncated, and one way to truncate it is something like this value. And then let's see from the Let's see the profile plot here of the scattering transform. It's more evident. So all the way to 15, it looks rather good. But then beyond this, it starts to behave badly. And the point here is that this exponential function, this e to the ick, becomes very big when these numbers, they get bigger here. So this is due to numerical noise, actually, I believe. And then from the, by cutting off the scattering transform at k equal to 15, we get some reconstructions. That's here. This is the blue one, and kind of gets most of the features of our original connectivity. But of course, maybe not of course, but as we see, the singularities, they're not really captured in the reconstruction. That's somehow because the singularities, they're somewhere in the scattering transform, far out in the asymptotic behavior of the scattering transform. So when we cut off the scattering transform, then it may be hard to see the jumps or the discontinuities. Okay. Let me just get to some conclusions here. So what have we developed here? An algorithm for 2D electrical impedance tomography for conductivities having essentially one derivative. But what to do when we don't have this kind of smoothness? That's pretty open, I would say. So we've done a numerical implementation of the two steps. The first step only when we have this radially conductivities. But of course, one could also ask what can we improve this computation of the scattering transform from the boundary data. That was some kind of approximation we're doing there. This algorithm seems to work well on this toy example, but what happens in case of more sophisticated examples, especially what happens if we consider real data? And at least, but not, we should at some point start considering 3D algorithms. There are algorithms available for 3D electrical impedance tomography in theory, but these things should be implemented at some point also. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. One question. Yes?
So, according to your simulation results, then there was also the error in the inside, deep inside, and the near the boundary is uniform.
Yes, yes.
So, how? So, is it right?
So, I don't think that is what you would expect, actually.
The error must be amplified in the deep inside.
In the interior, yes, yes. I haven't really analyzed that, what kind of errors you'd expect, but. But I think one would expect better reconstruction near the boundary. That's completely right. Yes, but
so the other example also shows the same feature.
Yes. They show this all the time. Yes, yes.
Okay.
No big difference between the inside and outside. No.
Mm-hmm. It was a very nice talk. Thank you. Okay, now for something completely different.